us all from epidemic. Most of them end up dying of typhus. Gisella is the name of Sonia's mother. She is sweet and kind and beloved. But her husband, Saul Youngerman, drives her crazy by taking terrible chances. Saul bribes the Ukrainians and Jewish police. He finds ways to bribe even the Gestapo. He organizes a smuggling ring to bring food inside the ghetto. Even though he knows the consequences of his foolish acts, Saul Youngerman makes secret contact with the partisans who skirmish with German patrols in the countryside. A Jewish informant, a criminal by the name of Feldman, reports to the Gestapo that Saul has smuggled a gun into the ghetto. This is not true, but it is a death warrant for Saul Youngerman. His wife, Gisella, is taken to Gestapo headquarters with him. Sonia and my sons would have been taken in also, but they are out in the streets, with Sonia looking for extra milk. I find them after a frantic search through the ghetto, standing in the sewers hiding. That same night, I play the piano at Kruger's house for dinner. He gives no sign that he knows my father-in-law is in his hands. Before I can summon up the words or the courage to ask about them, he dismisses me for the night. When Sonia discovers I have not even asked him about the fate of her parents, she turns her face from me. Again and again she turns away as I try to explain myself. Other members of the Judenrat come to see me about the fate of Saul and Gisella. We agree to go as one body to the office of Kruger to find out where they are so that at least we will have strength in numbers. Dr. Isaac Weinberger leads our delegation as the head of the Judenrat. Even the Nazis respect him because he treats and cures some members of the Gestapo when they break some bones after their truck goes into a ditch. When we see Kruger in his office, he strikes Weinberger with a swagger stick and beats the poor man while the others plead with him. Screaming, he tells us that there will be a special aktion for the Judenrat and our Jew families if we do not learn to respect his position. Then he comes up to me and screams that he knows I am behind this visit. So he says, "You wish to see your father-in-law." I do not speak because fear renders me mute, but I nod my head. He tells me that he knows what to do with swine, that this grandfather raises swine, and that swine always end up the same way. Then he takes me to the slaughterhouse outside the ghetto and takes me inside. Here is where the Gestapo have set up their jail and interrogation center. I hear people screaming and moaning, but I see no one. Kruger walks fast, and I follow him. The smell of blood and offal is everywhere, but I cannot tell if it is human or animal. We come to a guard at the door. "Are the Youngermans up for a visit?" he asks the German guard, in colloquial German that he thinks I cannot understand. The guard smirks and says yes, they are up for a visit from anyone. I walk into the darkness, and Kruger lights a lamp. They have hung Saul Youngerman on a meat hook. The spike has pierced him through the shoulder blades. I do not recognize his face because it has been beaten so badly. But he is still alive, and his swollen eyes are fixed on something across the room. Following his eyes, I see Gisella hanging by her feet, naked, and eviscerated with a long slit from her throat to her pubic area. Her intestines hang out of her, almost obscuring her face. Kruger walks out as I watch. I hear him vomit in the passageway. That night, he has me play Vivaldi's The Four Seasons for him at dinner. Even though she asks over and over, I never tell Sonia what I have seen at the slaughterhouse. I tell her that her parents have been taken away on a convoy. Nor do I tell the other members of the Judenrat. I do not feel that I should add any more to the common fear. By then, all of us know that we are at the mercy of lunatics and butchers. Sonia tries to hearten herself by thinking that her parents have been sent to work camps. I encourage this kind of thinking. Despair is a daily bread, and there is plenty enough to go around. In July, one more aktion and another 500 Jews are taken out to the slaughter. The Jewish fire brigade is brought out in the countryside and forced to dig a mass grave. Then the poor Jews have to strip naked so their clothes can be used to make uniforms for the Reich. One young Jewish man named Volinsky lunges at a Gestapo guard as he stands in line ready to face the machine guns. he has hidden a 6-inch knife taped to his thigh. The knife goes into the throat of the Gestapo man, who, strangling on his own blood, runs after Volinsky and stabs him with the bayonet. It does not take long. Volinsky is half dead when he plays his own special rendition of Taps for the Nazis. To honor Volinsky, the Germans round up another 500 Jews the next day for annihilation. I know. Along with other members of the Judenrat, I stay up all night to see which Jewish names are placed on the list. Always we choose the poorest and most helpless Jews among us. Always we choose the Jews we do not know or who are not related to us. All my life I have been a fanatic about cleanliness. But forget about hygiene in the ghetto. Like any other Jew, I have to survive in a landscape of utter filth. At night, the rats are emperors of the dark, and we hear them rattling the pots and pans, desperately looking for scraps of food. The best place for rats is by the cemetery, where they can grow fat on what meat they find on the bones of starved Jews. The bedbugs are so bad and so numerous that often we must rouse our children and go sleep out in the streets beneath the stars. In winter, we have no choice but to do war with the bedbugs, the roaches, and the lice. Water is precious. Even filthy, it is precious. One night, an old Jew takes time to close his eyes and bless the piece of bread he is about to eat, when a rat leaps out of a closet and snatches the bread from the old Jew's hands. The Jew goes berserk and kills the rat with his shoe, butchers it, and cooks it over an open fire, then devours it ravenously. A rabbi comes to him, not to chastise the old Jew for eating unkosher food, but to find out how the animal tastes. Such is the desperation of the Jews of Kironitska. A criminal named Berger is put in charge of the Ordnungsdienst after its first boss is shot down in the street by the Oberscharführer for not carrying out an order quickly enough. This Berger is built strong as a bull and is a common laborer carrying freight at the railroad station. He is a drunkard, a lout, and dumb as a goy jack, if you will excuse the expression. Jews like this Berger are sickening to other Jews, but they are circumcised according to the covenant, so what is one to do? The Nazis don't care if it's an Einstein or a Horowitz once they find the mezuzah on the doorpost and the foreskin cut. Berger is armed with a club and a uniform, and he loves to beat educated Jews into submission. Some fear him more than they fear the average German soldier. Some Jewish girls become whores for the Nazis or for anyone else who can feed them. If a German soldier sleeps with a Jewish girl, it is death for both of them because of the racial laws. But men will be men and women women, and for food one will do anything. Because I am a member of the Judenrat, we have more food than the others, so I do not worry as much. One day, in the main street of the ghetto, I am walking home from the factory after a day of reconditioning fur coats into warm uniforms for German soldiers on the Eastern Front. I am exhausted by the work and saw little hope. I am walking slowly home, head down, trying to attract the attention of no one, which is the best method of survival always. A commotion is suddenly around me like a storm, many shouts, people yelling and crying. I look up, and two members of the Gestapo have caught two young Jewish boys smuggling food into the ghetto. One boy is 10 and the other is 9. They are brothers, and they are crying as the soldiers slap their faces hard again and again. It is a square where they take these boys, and there are nooses hanging from a scaffold where they hang Jews and Poles and Ukrainians who displease the Nazis. The Nazis love to hang people to make examples to others. Kruger drives up at this very moment in a jeep. Both boys are crying hard as they are forced toward the scaffold, but since they are obviously just boys, I think that they will be all right. They have been trying to smuggle tins of fish and a bottle of vodka into the ghetto, things that now fetch an unbelievable price. Like a charade, the boys are lifted up on stools and their hands are tied behind their backs, and nooses are put around their necks. The scene is so ghastly, and I hear Jews moaning because they know it will do no good to lift their voices in protest. I myself feel like I am walking through some unimaginable landscape that would make sense only if I am in a nightmare. I cannot take my eyes off the boys, who, under ordinary circumstances, would be playing soccer in some schoolyard. Then I hear my name being called, and it is Kruger who sees me and orders me to come out of the crowd that has gathered. They are only boys, I say, with my head bowed, and he strikes me with a riding crop on the face, and I taste blood in my mouth. Then there is another outbreak of noise, and a man fights his way to the front of the crowd. It is Berger, the pompous ruffian who leads the Ordnungsdienst. He cries out, "These are my sons, the sons of your obedient servant Berger, who will punish these sons within an inch of their lives. I so swear to my Maker." "These are not boys or sons," Kruger says to the crowd. "These are enemies of the Reich, who must be punished by the harshest measures." Kruger reaches up, and he makes sure that the nooses are tight. Both boys begin screaming for their father, who tries to fight his way to them, but is felled by a blow to the back of the head from a rifle butt. But Berger is ox-like and maddened with fear, and the screams of his sons bring him staggering to his feet, as he calls out to his boys not to worry. In Yiddish, he keeps telling his sons that Yahweh will protect them. But Yahweh is taking a long vacation, far away from his chosen people in those years. He was not in Eastern Europe, Jack, of that I am certain. Again, I hear my name called out by Kruger. He says it softly, in an almost friendly way, so the crowd does not hear. "You are a member of the Judenrat, a leader of your people," he whispers to me. "Let me see you make the hard decision. Perform the action that wartime requires of all the servants of the Reich. For so long, Jews have been parasites and leeches. You perform an act that will help rid the Reich of such vermin. You hang those two pieces of shit, piano player." Berger begins pleading for his children's lives, and I hear German soldiers trying to beat him into silence, but he is strong and like an animal. He is clawing his way forward, until restrained by three members of the Gestapo, who appear from nowhere. Then Kruger says to me, and these are the words that change something in me, Jack. He says, "If you do not hang them now, I will hang your pretty Sonia and all your pretty children on these same gallows tomorrow." With these words, I do not hesitate to act for a second. I walk up to those boys, and with their father watching me in hatred, I kick those stools from under those boys. Kruger holds my neck as I try to turn away. He makes me watch the boys twitch and struggle and die in agony. It takes much longer for the younger boy to die than it does for the older one. Berger howls out in pain, and I think I have never heard pain like that. It is so pure. They drag him off, and I later hear that they take him to Gestapo headquarters. Only the whores come back from there alive. When I get home, I tell my Sonia what I have done, and she holds me tightly and kisses my face again and again. She tells me not to worry or to suffer, that we are being tested as Jews, and we will survive as Jews, and that we will show them all that we come from people who have been persecuted for 3,000 years. They can do anything to our bodies, she tells me, kissing me, holding me tight to her breast. They can starve us and torture us and slaughter us by the tens of thousands, but our souls remain our own. They cannot rob us, my husband, of who we truly are. Sonia was right about herself. She was wrong about George Fox. That night, Kruger asks me to play something by Haydn, and I play something instead by Telemann, and the poor idiot has no idea of my deception. It is no sin not to have culture. It is a sin to pretend. That night, as I played Telemann, I pretended that I am playing before a royal audience in London, and that I play so brilliantly that even the taciturn British rise to give me a standing ovation. I even pretend that on this day I have not participated in the hanging of two innocent Jewish boys. Their blood is on my hands as I play Telemann. The monster, Kruger, begins showing signs of intense nervousness as the fall weather grows colder. Some days he does not leave the house. On others, he is tempestuous and brutal and everywhere at once. A Jewish family is discovered to have hidden gold and diamonds beneath a stone of a Christian church, and Kruger beats the entire family to death with a statue of Saint Joseph he commandeered from the church. One of his victims is a 2-year-old girl. The Jewish fire brigade is ordered to always have burial pits already dug for at least 500 other bodies. On one of his more manic days, Kruger comes to the factory where I am sewing coats. Every Jewish tailor who sees Kruger walk into the workplace almost has an instant heart attack. He has come to represent the angel of death himself in the ghetto. The administration of horror was taking a toll on even Kruger's face. His flesh is caving in on itself, as though he is rotting from the inside out. With his finger, he motions for me to come to him. What can I do? I am his slave, and of course I follow him. In the back of the jeep he puts me. He spits on my Star of David, as though to remind me what he thinks of all Jews. It is almost comical to me, for I should need any reminding. He drives me through the streets of Kironitska and stops outside of an orphanage that is filled with small children. It is the month a huge shipment of Hungarian Jews arrives in the ghetto, which does not want them and has no use for them. The Jews of Kironitska treat the Hungarian Jews abominably, except for a few notable exceptions. Always, among humans, it is the notable exceptions that make God's creation of mankind seem like a good idea. But at the orphanage this day, the very idea of mankind is turned on its head. In trucks, they have loaded over 100 children, the smallest ones, the most helpless. 12 of them are not even Jewish. 4 have committed the crime of being Polish. 8 are guilty of being Ukrainian. There are many infants, some are crying, most are too weak to cry. Kruger's jeep leads a small caravan out of town. I must tell you that I am fearing for my own life more than for anything on this trip. Not once can I remember thinking of any of these poor children. For 1 hour we drive until we get to the high country, the mountains barely visible from Kironitska on a clear day. We come to a bridge overlooking a gorge with a raging river 300 feet below. It is such a height as not to be believed. The soldiers begin with the toddlers. Taking them by the feet, they put each child into a burlap bag. Most children cry, others struggle. Some are already half dead and protest not at all. Kruger takes out a beautiful hunting rifle that he tells me he used to hunt stag and wild hogs in Bavaria. It has carvings on the stock. On the drive to the bridge, the German soldiers have gotten drunk on brandy. One by one, they pick up these packages of unwanted children and throw them over the bridge into the river far below. The bridge seems to come apart with the special terror of children. The ones who are not packaged go into a panic. Some cry out for their mothers. None really know what is happening, and that is the only humane thing about this indescribable scene. Kruger loads his rifle and takes aim. He takes shots at about every third child or infant as it is tossed off the bridge. He is a marksman famed even in the SS. He attempts to spin each bundle he fires at. One baby he spins 3 times before he hits the river, and the German soldiers cheer Kruger for his accuracy. He has one run of hitting 15 children in a row, before missing a baby he does not fire at until it almost hits the river. Before long, he grows impatient with the game and carefully replaces his rifle in its case. He yells at the soldiers to hurry up their work, and they begin throwing the last 20 or 30 children into the gorge without even bothering to package them up. I see 5 naked babies plunging toward their deaths at varying heights above the gorge. Those babies are flying and innocent and doomed. Soon the work is finished, and we drive back to the city. Kruger never directs a single word toward me, and I know that if I speak, he will put a bullet through my brain. That night, he asks that I play something beautiful for him, something that will ease the great agony that comes with his command. I play the Concerto No. 21 of Mozart, because it has a kind of secret beauty. In the middle of my playing, he begins to weep, and I understand that he is drunk again. He begins to talk, but he does not talk about those slaughtered children. He talks of duty, stern duty. To be a good soldier, he must carry out each and every order of the Führer with all the ferocity he can muster. It would be easy for him to be soft, because as a civilian he is known for his softness and kindness and good cheer. Everyone tells him he spoils his children, especially his daughter, Bridget. He is a banker in his other life, and his only problem is he wants to lend everyone money. It hurts him to say no, even to the drunkards and the wastrels. For an hour he tells me in a monotone voice what a softy he is, how he loves to pick basketfuls of wildflowers for his Bridget, how he loves to play goalie against his two sons, and always makes sure he allows them to score before they return home for dinner. I play Mozart, and I try to mind my own business. He weeps and drinks, weeps and drinks. Then he passes out, and I tiptoe out of his house and walk back through the ghetto on the night that Kruger has ordered over 100 orphans thrown to their deaths from a bridge in the Ukraine. If there is a God, Jack, those orphans are to have met Kruger on a bridge overlooking hell. God should then turn his back, as he did on his chosen people in the years I describe, and not turn around, no matter how piteous the screams of Kruger become, no matter how long they last, and I pray it is eternity. Every day I pass more and more starving people. Their legs swell up and change colors. They move oddly, as though they are underwater, and you begin to recognize those people who will be dead in just a few days. They have an aura and a stench, and you learn to avoid them by walking far around them. Because I am a member of the Judenrat, a tailor at the factory, and the piano player of Kruger, my family is well fed, considering. We live in filth and squalor, but we are as well fed as any Jews in the ghetto. For this I am grateful, and my beautiful Sonia and my children are all alive. Then a Jew named Sklar, young, fiery, athletic, meets a Nazi who has come to arrest his mother and father with a jar of hydrochloric acid. This Sklar hurls the acid into the face of the Nazi beast, who screams as the acid burns out his eyeballs and half his face. This Sklar is killed immediately by other Germans, and his parents are both shot in the head. Kruger orders that body be publicly hanged and set on fire. But the bloodlust of Kruger is not satisfied with such tame retribution. The Nazi without eyes or half a face is sent to his home in Dusseldorf, and Kruger calls the Judenrat together for a night meeting, in which he demands 300 Jews to be hanged on the lampposts of Kieranitska in reprisal for the attack on a soldier of the Reich. The Judenrat puts out a call for volunteers, but it is a rare man who volunteers for his own execution. The members of the Judenrat nearly go mad with anguish. Then the very old men are snatched up for the gallows, and the reasoning is that they have tasted enough of life. Then the hospital is raided, and the very sick are driven out of their beds. The insane are grabbed, and we tell ourselves we are doing them a favor, since they don't know the difference between life or death. Kruger is a black god whom we must obey as we select our fellow Jews for the slaughter. When we come up short with numbers, Kruger screams that he will hang every member of the Judenrat along with our families if we do not provide him with these souls. Then, to our great luck, we think then and suffer later, a shipment of Hungarian Jews arrives at the station. From lampposts, from rafters, from newly constructed gallows, 300 Jews are sacrificed for one blind Nazi. Kruger lets them hang there until their bodies begin to decompose. On the night he lynches those Jews, Kruger has me play Wagner for him. Wagner, the anti-Semite. But Kruger is a stupid man, and his musical wishes this night do not reflect any sense of irony on his part. Again, he gets drunker and begins to mutter, "You do not know the cost. You do not know the cost." I play the piano as though I do not hear him. I play Wagner as this night 300 Jewish men cross the Red Sea into the Promised Land. 300 men, men who have kept the covenant with their Creator, swing in the cold winds that come down from the frozen mountains around Kieranitska. I know the cost, Herr Kruger. I know the exact cost, because you made me help select each one of them. Judenrat. I can barely speak this name out loud. The shame I feel when I speak this word causes such despair that I have trouble breathing after I say it. In the Warsaw Ghetto, the head of the Judenrat kills himself. This is the only proper response, I think. But it requires a courage I walked into this war without. What will Sonya and my sons do if I slit my wrists or eat rat poison? I know 4 families who took rat poison altogether, so they could die on their own terms. I wait until the Nazi beast grows hungry and looks around to feed. Who would think that the Nazi beast would one day turn toward pretty Sonya? Single-mindedly, I make up my mind that my wife and children will survive, and the whole rest of the world be damned. Yet one day they close down the factory for suspected sabotage of a machine. But it is nothing, and they send us all home with threats and no extra food ration for that day. I come to the crowded apartment where my family is housed among many families, including new arrivals from Hungary. My children are there, being taken care of by an old Jewish farm woman from the country. I ask about my wife as I take the baby, and my 2 older sons come to my lap and search my pockets for food. It is difficult to utter the sounds of my sons' names. When Sonya returns, she is surprised to see me, then very ashamed. I ask her where she has been, for it is dangerous for any attractive woman to be walking the streets with the Ukrainian police and the German soldiers always on patrol. She puts a finger to my lips, looks down at the floor, and says, "Please do not ask my husband." That same night, the city sleeping, the snoring of strangers, a blanket separating us from the others, I reach over to bring my wife to me. I want to take comfort in her body. I wish to forget everything as I make love to her. She kisses me as always, then tells me that we can never make love again, that she has shamed me and shamed our families, and that she can never be held by me again. She cries very hard in the darkness and asks my forgiveness. Over a month ago, the monster Kruger comes to her and orders her to come to his house because he has decided that she will make a suitable whore. He goes to great lengths to tell her that he does not believe in the laws of racial purity espoused by the Nazis, but pays lip service to them for the sake of his career. Before him, she trembles and begs him not to make her do this. But because this Kruger is king of this portion of hell, he laughs at her and tells her he will be happy to shoot her husband and children down in the streets, then bring her to live in his house as a servant. Then he quits his explanation, his moment of seduction begins to bore him, and he rapes her on the couch near the piano. Each day he requires her to report to his house. Sonya begs Kruger not to let me know about her degradation. In his kindness, Kruger agrees to this. "Each time it is a rape, dear husband," good Sonya says to me. Then she explains that she cannot love me because Kruger has given her syphilis. Sweet Sonya. Her suffering and shame that night in my arms are almost too much for either of us to bear. But toward morning, we pledge our love to each other anew. They can take everything away from us, but our love for each other is forever. You think you have heard and imagined the worst that can happen to the ghetto Jews. Then something else happens, so horrible that you shut down completely. You pray that you can imagine nothing. Your prayers are answered. You learn that evil is bottomless. The despair I feel in my stomach is like a paralysis. As I tell you this, Jack, I worry now about how I am telling it. Does he think I am exaggerating, I ask myself? Am I leaving out important details that would convince him of the authenticity of these events? Should I hide details that seem too lurid or unbelievable? Do I sound sincere enough? What do you think, Jack? Say something. Your eyes. I have always hated your eyes. Kruger eyes. The eyes of Germany, ha! The eyes of my son-in-law. Typhoid comes. Then cholera. As it begins to grow colder, the end of the ghetto comes nearer. Things are not going well for the German army on the Russian front. Mother Russia is beginning to eat the armies of its invaders, as it always does. The looks on German faces begin to change. The dead begin to be put out on the streets like morning garbage. Kruger begins to talk to me as though we were old friends. He has a need to talk, so he chooses me. He does not like for me to answer out loud, so I nod as my fingers move along the keyboard. I learn to look sympathetic to his plight, to the agony of his command. He tells me something interesting. The monster, Kruger, tells me that I will never understand what it is like to have an entire city under my control. He knows that the city is ruled by pure terror, but he has learned that terror has its limits. I am playing Dvorak as he tells me this. He spills his cognac as he contemplates this dilemma. Every life in Kironitska is there for the taking. He, Kruger, can order everyone killed. In Gestapo headquarters, men and women are tortured to death frequently. He knows about nails under the fingernails and the pain it causes. Every place on the body can be used for torture. Scissors can be forced up nostrils, down eardrums, up anuses. Scrotums can be removed brutally. Every orifice can be turned into a tunnel of what he calls exquisite pain. Every tongue can be made to talk, then ripped out. He realizes that human suffering no longer touches him at all. He can order 10,000 people killed, and will think more about killing a fly with the heel of his boot. His daughter has come down with pneumonia, and his son is making bad grades in school. He tells me he wishes his wife were a better cook. He had once played goalie on an elementary school soccer team. It will not be long now, he says, but he does not explain. Tonight he would like to hear Mozart instead of Beethoven. The idiot does not know I was playing Dvorak. The next day, 2,000 people are gathered together in an action, taken out to a mass grave dug by the Jewish fire brigade, and machine-gunned in the snow. This time there is a surprise. This time they also kill all the members of the fire brigade. That night I am playing, and Kruger is drunk when he arrives. I am playing Brahms. He comes and stands beside me as I play. He has never done this. He touches my shoulder in a fraternal way, as if we are good friends. Then he puts his fingers under my nose. It is rough, it is sudden. That smell, he says, that is your Sonia. Do you recognize that smell? It belongs to me, forever. I own that smell. Do you hear me, Jew? I own that smell. That is what my whore smells like. He seems almost ashamed after he says this. Then he gets angry at me. He slaps me hard and I fall off the stool. I rise and get back on the stool and resume my playing. He throws the cognac in my face. He screams that he hates Jews worse than Hitler does, that he will help his Führer kill all of them. He then says that I am the only one who understands him, that I am his friend, that he loves Sonia more than he loves his disgusting wife. He is worried about his daughter. He fears falling into the hands of the Russians. He grows sick. He vomits beside the piano. But it will be over soon, very soon. He vomits again. He passes out in his own vomit. I call the Ukrainian housekeeper, and together we carry him to his bedroom. I walk out into the night. I have never played Brahms again. I cannot. Brahms died for me, and I cherished Brahms. There is something I must tell you about Sonia and me. After I learn about Kruger, I think it will poison the love between me and Sonia. She thinks the sight of her may repulse me. I think I may never be able to meet her gaze again. But that does not happen. Our love grows stronger, and we cling to each other as though we are the last two people on earth who have not lost the capacity for love. We promise each other that Kruger cannot pollute the thing that is most beautiful between us. Our bodies and our fates belong to him, but we belong to each other. Sonia, Sonia, Sonia. There is not so much left now. In February, in the dead of winter, the ghetto of Kironitska is eliminated. Fewer than 1,000 Jews are left to be loaded into trains. Kruger comes to bid Sonia and me farewell. Though he cannot say it, I can see he is sorry we are leaving. He is in love with my Sonia. I can see this, and it hurts him that Sonia looks at him with eyes that despise him. This monster, Kruger, is a lonely man. I have been lonely for 40 years, and I know about Kruger's loneliness. The train goes for 2 days, then stops in the freezing darkness. Our baby, Jonathan, dies on this night, and it breaks something in Sonia. Other people, mostly old, freeze to death. The train moves off again. There is no water or facilities. Men and women must excrete. The smell shames us. The smell causes us despair. The sound of the children begging for water. Well, you can imagine what it is like. Except you cannot. I carry that journey on the train with me. The train breaks Sonia. It breaks her. All that we have endured, and it is the train. My pretty Sonia dies before the Germans are kind enough to put her in the gas chamber. When they open the doors at Auschwitz, Sonia has lost her mind. She has gone on ahead. They have to pry her hands from around our baby, Jonathan. Here is my tattoo, Jack. The Germans love lists, catalogues. Everything has its place. Because of my gift as a musician, they know I am coming. I am directed toward the line of life. Sonia and my twin sons go toward the line of death. The boys stand on either side of their mother, protecting her. They know that their mother is no longer there, and even though they are only boys, both seem to grow into manhood in that line. They have to lead their mother to her death. Both wave goodbye to me, secretly, so the Germans will not see. They are marched away into eternity. I try to catch Sonia's eye, but she is no longer there. I see her walk out of my life, and I can still see, after all these terrible years, these things that have happened, I can see why she was once called the most beautiful woman in Europe. I am putting on the camp uniform when I am hit by a blow from behind that knocks me to the floor. Then I am kicked in the stomach, then the face. There is commotion, and I think a German guard is going to kill me in the changing room. It is Berger, the Jewish ruffian from Kironitska, the one whose boys stole food and who were hanged for the crime. All Berger remembers is that I kicked the stools out from beneath his sons. This Jew is mine. Berger is a Sonderkommando, one of the accursed Jews who is forced to remove the corpses from the gas chambers and take them to the crematoriums. Each day he comes to find me to beat me some more. He is like some king among the damned, some Kruger. Finally, he comes to take me away and slaps me and cuffs me on the back of the head. He passes easily through the barracks. Guards in the tower see him, and he walks as though he were the concierge in this place. He brings me to a place, and I hear Jewish voices singing a Hebrew song in praise of the Almighty. It is dark, and the air is filled with black smoke. Then a screaming begins that is like no other sound on earth. Then there is silence. Berger knocks me to the ground again. He yanks me to my feet and pushes me ahead of him where other Jews are gathered, and one of them is turning a wheel. Inside a door, I am pushed and told to do what he does. There is a stack of dead Jews, hundreds of them, mostly women and children and old people. I work hard to help remove them. I work beneath the blows of Berger. I drag bodies by the feet. Some are almost weightless. I am dragging one body when Berger stops me and makes me look down. It is Sonia. Then he makes me dig through the pile until I find my sons. I find them and bring them to Berger. He hands me pliers and tells me to pull all the gold teeth from Sonia's mouth. He yanks her mouth open and pulls out the first one in the most brutal manner. I cannot move, but he hits me in the face with the pliers. I open Sonia's mouth. I remove a tooth. Berger takes the pliers and begins to pull all the teeth out of her head. This Berger, too, is insane, and he is also innocent. Later, there is a Jew who works in administration, who has seen me in concert in the old days. He is a great lover of music. He finds out that Berger has me working night and day with the Sonderkommando. This unknown Jew is king of his realm, and he puts Berger's number in a section marked for death. They come to get Berger, and I am there when he is taken from a pile in the gas chamber. The rest of Auschwitz is just Auschwitz. You can read about it. My experience is the same. I work, I suffer, I starve. Once I nearly die of dysentery. To survive, I play the music I love in my head all my working hours. I ask that the great composers assemble in my head to play their finest works for me. In squalor, I dine each night in my tuxedo with Beethoven, Bach, Mozart, Chopin, Liszt, Haydn, Puccini, Rimsky-Korsakov, Mahler, Strauss, Tchaikovsky, and all the others. Each evening I dress slowly, taking care with my cufflinks and studs, and tying and retying my black tie until I get it just right. Before we play, I go to the great restaurants of Europe, and I order the finest meals cooked by the finest chefs. I eat escargot glistening with butter and flecks of garlic and parsley, order roast duck with crisp brown skin and pods of fat just beneath the wing bones, eat baguette dipped in olive oil and creme brulee with burnt crusts of brown sugar, followed by layers of sweet cream that make the mouth pucker with pleasure. We would eat, not gorge, these great composers and I. Because I live in my head, I survive by concentrating on the great silos of beauty I have stored up. I hear music amid the squalor, and I do what I promised myself I will not do under any circumstance. I survive. I disgrace myself by surviving. In the winter of 1945, I joined one of the forced marches when the Russians were nearing Auschwitz. We marched through snow and without food or rest. Many men fall by the wayside and receive bullets. These bullets must have felt like gifts. I am in Dachau when the Americans liberate the camp. I remember none of this. Later, I am shown a pile of naked bodies. You know those photographs. Piles and piles of dead scarecrows. The person showing me the photograph is a doctor who has taken the picture. After snapping the picture, he thinks he sees my chest move. He checks my pulse and races me to the hospital tent. My left hand is frostbitten and gangrene has set in. He removes the little finger of my left hand. I can move the ring finger once I awake, but it never regains feeling. I have always regretted that this doctor took that picture. He should have left me on that pile. I was going back to Sonia. Ruth finds me in a DP camp where she is searching for survivors of her family. She hears about a Jew looking for survivors from Kironitska. We get married, and because of this, I ruin the life of this very good woman. I kiss her, and I know she sees in my eye that I am wishing for Sonia. I make love to her, and sometimes I whisper Sonia's name. Shaila and Marta are born, and I am also disappointed because they are not the sons that I lost. I love none of them. They disappoint me because they are not my dead family. I cannot love Ruth, Jack. I try and I cannot do it. I cannot love Shaila or Marta. I can only love phantoms. I go to sleep loving all my ghosts and do not wake up until my Shaila leaps from the bridge. So, Jack. Part 6, Chapter 35. I hated the 60s, and I especially hate the memories I carry from the noise and bedlam and discourtesy of those cacophonous years. The shouting is what I recall most clearly, then the posturing, then the lack of hygiene. It is the only decade I have lived through that did not have the decency to call it quits when its time had run out. 1970, for me, was the worst year of the 60s by far. It made me hate folk music and piety and facial hair and tie-dyed shirts and political rhetoric of any kind. My idea of hell is to be caught in an airport lounge during a snowstorm, listening to an aging hippie songstress whacking away at her scratched-up Martin guitar. As she plays Blowin' in the Wind, Puff the Magic Dragon, I Gave My Love a Cherry, Lemon Tree, and We Shall Overcome, in that order. Once I was a wide-eyed captive of those times, and there was no 12-point program to wean me off the addiction to drivel I succumbed to during that dreary era of the Vietnam War. The greatest tragedy of that war was not the senseless death of young men on strangely named battlefields, but that it turned the whole country stupid overnight. It also made enemies of the closest group of friends I had ever known. We accidentally let ourselves be caught up in the zeitgeist, and we were never the same again, any of us. After the smoke had cleared, I promised myself I would never lose a friend because of something as subjective and slippery as political belief. I'm an American, I announced to all around me, and I get to think anything I want to, and so do you, by God, so do you. It became my credo, the central theme of my life. But if it had not been for the intolerance and pig-headedness I exhibited with such grandiosity in those years, and the weird sideburns and holier-than-thou attitude that I paraded around with, I would have entered into my maturity as uninterested in the world of ideas as any other Southerner. My whole character formed around the issue of Vietnam, and it nearly brings me to my knees to admit it. The Thursday after Lucy's party, I drove up Highway 17 to Charleston with Ladere riding shotgun. We drove with the windows open, and the smells of harvested crops and leaf-branded rivers filled up the car, and the wind slid through Ladere's honey-colored hair. Mike had sent invitations to both of us, requesting our presence at the Dock Street Theater in Charleston at precisely 2 p.m. No response was requested, but he phrased the invitation in a way that left no room for excuses for not showing up. "What's Mike up to?" I asked. "No good," she said. "You know, don't you?" "He's got something up his sleeve," she said, casting me a quizzical glance. "But he's kept it secret." "Why?" "He thinks we wouldn't show up if we knew what this was all about." No theater in America can match the Dock Street Theater for both its intimacy and understated majesty. It has the hushed feeling of a building holding its breath, and its serenity grants comfort to both actors and audiences. It has the spare look of a Shaker church, and just being there makes you want to rush home to write a play. The stage is the size of a small dance floor, and as we entered, I saw Mike watching a camera crew and sound man, whom Ladere said he had flown in from the West Coast. I remembered that Mike had told me it was at the Dock Street Theater he had seen his first play as a child, a performance of Arthur Miller's The Crucible. It was so powerful that it had changed the course of his life forever. He grew up loving to watch actors pretending they were someone else, and speaking the made-up lines of strangers in love with the energy and passion of language. Though Mike had started out in the theater, he soon gravitated toward the world of film. In the theater, he said, he could create a sense of vibrancy, tension, and style, but in a movie, he could make a whole world by allowing light to imprint shapes on moving rivers of film. One of the first things he did after the success of his first film was to join the board of the Dock Street Theater. Mike never forgot where he came from. "Let's wrap it up in about 10 minutes, Mike said to the crew, who were working with precision and speed. "Everybody knows the drill. Once we get started, my guests are not to be aware you boys are in the building, comprende? You're neither to be seen nor heard. We're not after art here, I just want this recorded," he said, as Ladere and I moved down the front aisle. "What union rules apply here?" the man setting up camera angles asked, and his voice was teasing. "None, Mouse Dick," Mike said, smiling. "South Carolina's a right-to-work state. Ever since Fort Sumter, they've hated everything that even reminded them of the word union." "What's this for?" a cameraman shouted from a rear balcony. "Just a home movie," Mike said, clapping his hands. As we approached Mike, he clapped his hands again, and his crew disappeared, and we did not see them again. His preparation was exacting and precise. We were the first to arrive. "You're early," Mike said. "Early makes me nervous." "Then we'll leave," Ladere said. "No, I've staggered the time of arrival for everyone. Capers and Betsy were supposed to get here first, but they're late. Go up and take your seats. You're on stage left. The food's to die for, and there's plenty to drink.
What are our roles? Ladere asked.
Today we improvise. Anything goes. Everything out on the table, Mike said. It'll become clear to you when everyone shows up. A movement caught my eye in the back of the theater, and I turned to see the straight-backed silhouette of General Rembert Elliott, standing at attention beside the back rows. He was joined by a taller, gray-haired man, and it surprised me when I saw my own father walking down the aisle dressed in his judicial robes. Together, they had driven up from Waterford. A woman cleared her throat behind me on stage, and I turned to see Celestine Elliott, who must have entered by the stage door, watching her husband approach with a look that could have shattered chrome. When he saw his wife, General Elliott halted in his tracks and watched as she took her seat on the left side of the stage. I knew that they had not seen each other since the disastrous visit to Rome, and had only communicated through the offices of their attorneys. The general bowed to me and Ladere with exaggerated formality.
"It scares me, Jack," Ladere said, as we watched them make their way to their places.
"What?" I asked.
"When I'm 70, I want all my mistakes behind me. I want 30 years of good and brilliant living behind me. Look at them. The judge, the general, Celestine, they're all in agony. I couldn't bear it if I thought the rest of my life would be as painful as my past."
"Introspection's a mistake," I said. "Be happy drifting along the shallows."
"That's no answer," she said.
"I agree," I said, "but at least it's a game plan." Capers Middleton gave a shout of greeting to everyone as he and Betsy made their bold, confident entrance from the rear. Everything about them seemed exaggerated to me, as if their metabolism was burning a bit brighter than the rest of ours. Their smiles seemed like grimaces to me. Like every politician I'd ever seen, Capers's eyes took in all the players in the room at a single glance. I saw him nod at Ladere, but the gesture was condescending, dismissive. When Capers left someone behind, it was permanent, and he granted no right of appeal unless, of course, he found he needed a favor from that person along the way. With businesslike economy, he steered Betsy to their seats on the stage, wasting no time on small talk with Mike or us. Though it was vitally important to Capers that he seem in command of every situation, I could tell that he was nervous in the midst of this gathering from our mutual pasts. Mike checked his watch and looked toward the side door of the dark street. My father had taken his place behind a desk on a raised platform with a judge's gavel on the desk. He hit the hammer twice on the oak desk, more to break the extraordinary tension than anything else. He looked more broken than old, and I realized how much I had neglected him since my return to Waterford and my clumsy attempts at caring for my mother. I tried to make myself feel about him the way I thought a son should about his father, but I could not fake an emotion that was not there. Pity surged through me unbidden when it was love I was after. My father stood up, smoothed out his robes, and adjusted his tie and collar. Then he sat down and resumed his seat like the rest of us. Mike had arranged the seating brilliantly. At the back of stage center was the judge's chair and table, and directly to the right was a handsome, high-backed chair. Flowing from this centerpiece were comfortable plush chairs set in big semicircles and facing each other. They were color-coordinated, lending an atmosphere that was both convivial and homey. On the left side sat Ladere, Celestine, and I. Next to me was a chair as yet unoccupied. Across from us were Capers, Betsy, General Elliott, and another unoccupied chair. Behind each of our chairs had been placed several taller wooden chairs. High above me on the left, I caught the barely perceptible movement of a cameraman adjusting a lens. Mike stood at center stage, next to the judge, near the high-backed chair, where he could see all of us easily. "Welcome, my friends, and thank you for joining me today. I want all of you to know that you're being filmed and recorded. If you feel like speaking out, just raise your hand, and Judge McCall will grant you permission to speak. When I take my seat, this will become like a court of law. The judge will preside. He is the only paid participant tonight. The rest of you are here because you've all been important to me in some way. I'm bound by my love and admiration for you. I've known most of you my whole life." "Why here?" Mike asked rhetorically. "Because I thought in this theater we could come together as though we were in a play, a drama that we will write together tonight.
I have brought two mystery guests to the Dock Street. This play will have surprises, but it will also have resolution. All of us will vote at the end of this performance. The man on trial has given me his permission to allow each of you to cast a vote, deciding his fate. Ah, I see you're interested. Intrigued, perhaps. Hooked. I would give you the rules, but there are no rules. You are going to be asked to do nothing more or less than sit in judgment on the past. All of you, except Betsy, were either participants in the events we are about to describe together, or witnesses. Some of you are the stars of this production, but all of you helped move the action in some way. Hamlet would not be Hamlet without Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, and this story would be incomplete without each of you. Everyone knows that Capers, Jack, and I were inseparable growing up. When I think of friendship, these are the two names that come to me first. Jack and I have grown apart, and this hurts me more than I can say. I think it is also safe to say that Jack hates Capers, or at least dislikes him very much. I sat in my place across from Capers and looked directly into his eyes and said, "Hate's the word, Mike." Capers' wife, Betsy, who was seated next to her husband, said, "I told you from the beginning, Mike, I don't like this at all. I won't sit here and let my husband be criticized by a fake sous chef." I smiled and said, "I like you for your mind, Betsy. I wept during that last beauty pageant when you played Ode to Joy on the kazoo." "Don't bully my poor wife, Jack," Capers said. "It doesn't become you." My father rapped his gavel on the desk at center stage and said, "That'll be enough, son." "You don't get it," Capers said. "I still love you, Jack. That's what this evening's all about." "Then it's going to be a long evening, pal," I said. The gavel came down again. "I want order here." Again, the gavel hammered against the oak desk, and this time I kept quiet before my father's red-faced fury. General Elliot stood up from where he sat, every inch the military man, his barren, authoritarian, fractious. He still looked as though he could swim a river and cut the throat of every guard near an ammo depot. "This evening's about my son, isn't it?" he asked Mike. "What happened to Jordan is central to everything, General. All of us know that. If the Marine Corps hadn't stationed you on Pollock Island, none of this would have happened. Jack and Capers would still be best friends. You and Celestin wouldn't be getting a divorce. I think it's possible that even Shiloh might be alive today, though that may be a stretch. But Jordan's coming to town changed everything. He not only became our best friend, he became our destiny." "If you know anything about the whereabouts of my son, then you are required to report it to the federal authorities. If you know where he is, you could be accused of harboring a fugitive. I'll turn you in myself, Mike, and you know I'm as good as my word."
"Shut up," Celestin said.
The judge rapped the gavel once more, a single, echoing note of order. The general turned again toward Mike. His voice was so pained, it was as if he were addressing the commander of a firing squad.
"If you know the whereabouts of my son, you have a moral obligation to report that information to the authorities," he said.
From behind the curtain at stage left, there was a slight movement, and Jordan Elliot, immaculate in his Trappist robes, walked to center stage. Another monk and Father Jude accompanied him part way, then took their seats at the side of the stage in the shadows.
"Hello, Dad," Jordan said to the general. "You never did know what happened. You know all parts of the story except mine."
"Two innocent people died because of you," the general said, his astonishment at the sight of his son removing some of the edge in his voice. "Instead of a soldier, I've raised a fugitive and a weakling."
"None of us knew it then, Dad," Jordan said. "But you had raised a priest."
"My church would not accept a murderer at the altar," said the general, staring at the other two priests on the stage.
The abbot rose and went to stand beside Jordan, then said,
"I met your son in Rome when he was a novice. I became both his sponsor and confessor. The forgiveness of sins is central to the profession of the Roman Catholic faith. Among the Trappists who have come to know him, your son is considered a good man by all, and a saintly man by some." "He is a disgrace to his country and his faith," the general said. "Who considers him a saint?"
"His confessor does," the abbot said, bowing and returning to his seat.
"I did not give you permission to sit down," the general said.
The abbot wiped his brow with his sleeve and said, "I don't need your permission to sit, thank you, General. You, sir, have retired, and your rank is merely decorative. I am presently the abbot of Mepkin Abbey, and my authority bears the weight and imprimatur of an unbroken 2,000-year spiritual reign. And do not raise your voice to me again, sir. Your son is here at my suggestion and forbearance, and I can take him away from here and hide him in places you've not dreamed of on this globe."
"Vatican II," the general sneered. "That's when the church went wrong. The fat pope who couldn't do a chin-up if his life depended on it got every liberal-thinking dildo and dandy he could dig up, got them together at Vatican II to dismantle everything that was true and unreplaceable in the Catholic Church. When the church was stern, the church was good. I loathe this new, limp-wristed, feel-good, touchy-feely church, where the priests and nuns screw like mink and play the guitar at high mass, singing Kumbaya."
My father hit his desk again and said,
"You're wasting time, General. You're rambling. It's time to move forward."
"There's one more mystery guest to present," Mike said. "Many of you won't know this guest except as legend. If you read the papers during our college years at Carolina, you'd recognize his name. Ladies and gentlemen, I introduce you all to Radical Bob Merrill, the leader of the Students for a Democratic Society at Carolina from 1969 to 1971. As I turned to watch Bob Merrill walk onto the stage behind me, I had a terrible realization that this night was going to be harder and more destructive on everyone than Mike had ever dreamt. I thought I hated Capers Middleton more than anyone in the world, but I had forgotten all about Radical Bob Merrill. Radical Bob had made a cameo appearance in all our lives, did incalculable damage, then dropped out of sight. Merrill walked over to Capers and the two men embraced. Bob then came across to Jordan and he embraced the priest. Turning to me, he extended his hand warily.
"If I take your hand," I said, "then the next stop's your throat."
"You should really try to grow up, Jack," Bob said. "It's time to let bygones be bygones."
"When you accepted this invitation tonight, Bob," I said, "did you figure out how you were going to get out of this theater without me kicking the shit out of you?"
The hammer sounded again. The judge cleared his throat, and Mike moved between the two of us.
"Who is Radical Bob?" my father asked.
Radical Bob was the original leader of the anti-war movement on campus that swept us all up in its activities, Mike explained.
"Where is all this leading, Mike?" my father asked.
"Judge," Mike said, delighted at his cue, "I can't answer that question until we come to the very end of this production." Ladere stood up and faced Mike. "What do you get out of this, Mike? You've always been generous, but you've never been generous to a fault."
"Thanks for that sterling recommendation, darling," Mike said. "But Ladere's right. I get the rights to Jordan's story for arranging this evening. If we decide that Jordan is guilty, then he'll turn himself in to the proper authorities on Pollock Island. Capers has offered his services as an attorney if Jordan is prosecuted for his crimes, free of charge."
"So Capers will look heroic to the voters of South Carolina," Ladere said. "Middleton to defend killer priest, boyhood friend."
"Cynicism makes you less pretty, dear," Capers said, smiling.
Ladere asked Jordan, "You agreed to let Capers be your lawyer?"
Jordan shook his head. "It's a nice offer, but it's the first I've heard of it." "If he defends you, I hope you get the electric chair," I said. "Jack, Jack," Capers said. "People will get the idea we've had a falling out."
"Mike," I said, rising out of my seat, "you get a movie out of this. Capers gets to be governor. Jordan, maybe, gets to go to jail. Tell me, why this stage, this setting, with friends and enemies gathered together in the same room? This could be settled privately. If Jordan is happy as a priest, then let him be happy. Leave him in peace. Let him walk off this stage and return to wherever he's come from. You've put Jordan in great jeopardy. And why? For one of your movies? For Capers' election?"
"No, Jack," Mike said. "I've noticed over the years how few times I've actually felt a part of a moment, electric, with every cell dazzled and tingling, with my whole body burning as though I were about to burst into flames. Listen to all of us breathing here. Feel the tension. This promises to be a night that none of us ever forgets. Our history surrounds and tortures us. Yet there was once love that traveled among us,
lighten us up and lighten our way. Tonight, I want us to find out together what happened to that love and why hatred can take the place of love with such ease.
How do we start? Capers asked.
My father hammered his gavel and said,
Whoever wants to speak must come to this witness chair. Whoever speaks must tell his or her truth, just as if this were a real court.
Our stories are all so different, Ladea said. I'm not the same person I was in college. I hate the girl I was.
Then tell us about that hatred, Mike said. All of us will tell our stories. There will be no order to the telling. Our stories will form some kind of truth that none of us at this moment grasps. All of our voices will form one storyline. None of us can be hurt in any way by what is said here, except Jordan Elliott. But if we come to some truth about Jordan, I think we can come to the truth about each of us, about what we did during that time.
Mike snapped his fingers, and the lights went out in the theater, leaving only the stage bathed in bright illumination. For a moment, there was complete silence, until the gavel rapped, and Mike said,
We return now to the Vietnam War. President Nixon is in the White House. The country is at war with itself. The campuses around the nation are temples of rage. In Columbia, South Carolina, we are in the middle of our college lives. We are Southern. We are basically apolitical. The war is popular in our state because South Carolina is conservative. Yet something is taking place at the university. The anti-war movement is taking hold and growing day by day. But we are still preoccupied with having dates for the football games and getting jobs after graduation. Ladies and gentlemen, I suggest to all of you that we walked into the history of our times without guile or preparation. We were sweet-natured, fun-loving, hard-drinking, fast-driving, quick-talking kids from Waterford. We could dance all night and often drove down to Myrtle Beach to do just that. The boys were all handsome and the girls were all pretty. We played hard, we laughed loud, and we were all in love with ourselves and our world. Then the larger world tapped us on the shoulder and introduced itself. Tapped hard, made its presence known. Let us begin, and please don't stop until we listen to everyone. Through a chorus of different voices and unique perspectives, the story began to unfold. My father called on people to speak, and at first he was strict about allowing no interruptions. The footlights bathed him in a mother-of-pearl corona as he listened, dressed in the black robes of justice, his authority unquestioned. He looked handsome and fine. Authority became him. He nodded first to Ladea, who understood his intent and took the witness chair. She had survived the battle we were about to relive by being a dispassionate witness, and it seemed fitting that it was she who would introduce the scene we were about to re-enter. As I listened to her sketch the background of those times, I realized that I never thought that Ladea had been paying any attention back then. It seemed to me that she had drifted along the fringes of cataclysm, impervious to outrage, and untouched by any of the fevers or seizures that shook the rest of us. Her choice was to watch and not participate, and as she spoke, I realized that she had become invisible to me back then, as she slipped into the role of observer, while the rest of us were pulled toward the epicenter.
Who knew anything about Vietnam at first? Ladea said, looking at my father. I mean, it had finally become a real war by the time we went to college. Sure, I watched all the demonstrations on TV, but South Carolina was different. I was far more interested in my sorority and good parties than anything else. All of us were like that. I thought more about makeup than the Mekong Delta. I was that kind of girl, and there's no sense apologizing for it because that's how I was brought up. My parents wanted me to be serious about finding a mate, and I had no responsibilities after that. College for them was a polishing off. The biggest deal on campus in my first 2 years was over the lack of student parking. I mean it. That was the real sore point among the students, what really got them riled up. Then things changed, almost overnight. Everyone noticed it. It was in the air.
Listening to her stirred my own memories, and it took me back to those college years when I had never felt more a part of things as I made my way to classes in that comely and welcoming campus. In that first year, the war was overwhelmingly popular, and all of us went to hear Dean Rusk speak when the Secretary of State came to campus to defend his Democratic administration's policies. By this time, it had become dangerous for Dean Rusk to appear on an American campus, but as Carolina students, we greeted him with enthusiasm and admiration. He warned against communism, the most terrifying word in the English language at that time. As Southerners, we could easily imagine working on a commune, but few of us could imagine living out the rest of our days as a godless people, bereft of our faith. And I thought quietly, the Vietnam War had another thing going for it in the South. We did not mind killing people or going to war against a nation we had never heard of. As Southerners, we distrusted the federal government when it levied taxes or tried to interfere with the integrity of state laws, but we trusted it completely when it sent its soldiers into perilous, watery climes to kill yellow people who spoke in unknown tongues. No recruitment officer ever had trouble meeting his quota in South Carolina. Then, in 1968, there was the Tet Offensive, the assassination of Martin Luther King, the murder of Robert Kennedy, the Chicago Convention, a whole coloratura of horror in transit along a timeline. As the dare continued, I remembered that our campus had been quiescent, indifferent, as students took over administration buildings at Columbia and Harvard. But hints and markings of change began to appear without the presence of any rhetoric or forethought. We started wearing our hair longer, grew mustaches, and the first beards began to appear. A gradual dressing down had begun subliminally, and an SAE boy in a suit began to look odd, a museum piece drifting as flotsam along Fraternity Row. The daughters of small-town insurance adjusters and Baptist ministers began to dress like hippies and stopped wearing makeup except on weekend visits home. Except for secession, no trend had ever had its birthplace in South Carolina. But the tumult on the other campuses and the anti-authoritarian tenor of the times could be measured by the length of the sideburns creeping down the faces of Carolina men. Girls like Ladea had their lives already written for them long before they went to college. Her beauty was safe and homegrown, not exotic like Shiloh's, not dangerous to the touch. The Tri-Delts rushed her, feted her. She was practically crowned before she ever stepped onto the campus. The high school cheerleader simply changed the color of her pom-poms and skirt and learned the new and much fancier routines of the college sidelines. Ladea was the kind of girl who dated the quarterback but married the guy who edited the law review. During her sophomore year, she reigned as Miss Garnet in Black, and she was homecoming queen her junior year. Except for Shiloh, few noticed she was Phi Beta Kappa and was majoring in philosophy. Throughout their time there, Shiloh tried to engage Ladea in political discussions, but Ladea felt safer in the libraries and in the blazing noise of autumn football crowds than locked in the malice of debate. She was frightened of the times, and she held back from them. Because she was so lovely, no one took the time to get to know her, including herself. And so it was in the Dock Street Theater that Ladea Ansley became the best person to describe the way we once were. She had seen the whole thing, observed it all from the top of homecoming floats. Only she could tell the point at which the everydayness of our college lives became inextricably bound up with the murderous urgencies of the war. Now, as I tuned back in to what she was saying, Ladea said it was Shiloh who held the key. It was Shiloh who changed the most, Shiloh who turned herself into a dangerous and fascinating woman, and Shiloh who brought Radical Bob into our close-knit group. On stage, Radical Bob Merrill laughed out loud when his name was mentioned for the first time. "Radical Bob," he said. "Hearing that takes me back a long way." "I agree with Ladea," Capers said, rising from his chair and addressing the audience after he replaced Ladea on the witness stand. "It's hard to describe Shiloh in those days. I don't remember Shiloh ever talking much during elementary or junior high school. Remember how painfully shy she was back then? It seemed to hurt her physically just to be looked at. That fragility seemed to melt away in high school. She got prettier every year, then sexier. Then you had that sheer intelligence, that brightness that could bully or tease or cajole. She could take over a room with her brain. In college, Shiloh discovered she was a leader. She'd have made a great Republican." Mike said, "She hated Republicans with her body and soul. She told me something during the McGovern campaign I've never forgotten. Shiloh said, They used to call Southerners who hated black people racists. Now they call them Republicans.
The Republicans haven't done a good job getting our message out to the black electorate, Capers agreed, but we're working on it.
If you get a single black vote, it means democracy ain't working, I said.
Coming from you, I take that as a compliment, Capers said.
The judge hammered his gavel and ordered,
That'll be enough from you, Jack. Settle down.
Capers began clapping, but the applause was mocking, increasing the tension.
A genius for exaggeration. A gift of Jack's as large as his overgrown body. He thinks his heart's as large as all outdoors. The pathetic fallacy of all American liberals. In theory, they love the black, the downtrodden, the crippled, and the poor. Yet you never find any of these people at their dinner table.
The gavel again, and the judge said,
Let's continue. You boys are like scorpions in a bottle.
General Elliot sat off to stage left, removed from everyone, his face a mask of disapproval. If he was listening, he gave no sign of it. He stared directly at his son, who returned the stare without judgment. Jordan, the priest, was every bit as erect and gaunt, as righteous and as handsome as the general. Only one great difference was manifest between them. The darkness that Jordan brought to the theater was soft and lauds polished. The general's darkness looked stolen from a firing range.
Capers and I'll take up this part of the story, Mike said, from the time when all of us boys grew our hair longer.
I let my hair grow down to my shoulder blades, Capers remembered.
Ladere said, Long hair's one thing, but none of us lost a friend in the war. No matter what else happened, none of our friends died in Vietnam.
Some of mine did, General Elliot said loudly, his voice a sudden force on stage.
But not Jordan, not your son. Jordan's right in front of you, Celestin said. He's here tonight facing you at last.
The general replied, Jordan's deader than any soldier who fought and died honorably in Vietnam, Celestin. He's invisible to me. His cowardice blinds me to his reality. There's a fog between us so thick, so impassable. A river of blood stands between us, the blood of men I ordered into battle. Every time I try to see my son, their blood gets in my eyes. Their names blind me when I try to catch sight of Jordan. All the names on the wall of the Vietnam Memorial come toward me. Hundreds of thousands of letters, the names of all the dead boys who did their duty, who did right by America. Their names march toward me in endless regiments when I try to catch sight of our cowardly son. Our Jordan.
There was a silence, a breathtaking silence, and then I stood up and screamed at General Elliot.
With assholes like you leading us, I'm amazed one American boy ever came back in one piece from Vietnam. How can one broken-down, rigid old fart know everything in the world? Answer me that, General. That's your son there. It's not a flag or an M1 or a guidon or a hand grenade or a parade ground or a foxhole. Yet you've shown more love and devotion to all these things than you've ever shown to your own son. You knocked Jordan around his whole childhood, and everyone here knows it. You knocked Celestin around, too, but only a couple of us know that. Oh, brave General of the Republic, who sits in judgment of his son tonight, you're not half the man your son is, and you never were. You're a child-beater and a wife-beater, a lightweight thinker, a first-class bully. And the only reason you're not a full-fledged Nazi is you can't speak German, and we've got this constitution that keeps shitbirds like you in check.
The gavel.
Shut up, Jack, and sit down. You're already too emotional, and we've hardly started.
No, Judge, Mike said. We're well into our drama.
I want to answer, Jack, the general said, rising to his feet and pointing his finger menacingly. Yours is the first generation that disgraced America. When this country called out to its sons, the lily-livered draft dodgers and mama's boys of your era wore girls' panties to their physicals, faked asthma attacks, poured sugar into their urine samples, went on diets to get below the weight limit, gorged themselves to exceed it, got girls pregnant to avoid the draft, joined the National Guard in droves to avoid combat. We needed men of iron in Vietnam, and we had to choose them from a nation of panty wastes. We had to select warriors from a defiled pool of pretty boys who were more comfortable on a therapist's couch than walking point in the jungle. Our nation rots from the inside out. It's a republic without gonads, one that's grown fat, effeminate, and bloated with all the gross excesses of a society gone to seed. It sickens me. You sicken me, Jack.
Well said, General, Capers said in the silence that followed. Celestine Elliott stood up and said,
Talk to us about loyalty, dear. You raised Jordan to believe that loyalty was the most sterling quality in a soldier.
I've not changed my mind, the General said, not looking at his estranged wife. But Jack would know nothing of the kind of loyalty I was talking about.
He could teach you some things about loyalty you've never dreamt of, she said. Jack never once turned his back on our son. He's been absolutely loyal to the only child we ever brought forth on this earth. He's never wavered, he's never backed off, he's never asked for anything in return, nor received a single thing in payment.
That's not true, I said.
What have you gotten from all this, Jack? Celestine asked.
Jordan's loved me. He's been an irreplaceable friend. He's made me less lonely in the world, I answered.
During this exchange, Jordan continued to keep his eyes